Hello, I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.05.00. This podcast is being published on Sunday, March 14, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio, the number 4, or .net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and Anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio, the number 4, ALL.net, and Anchor.fm. Today's episode title is The Confederatization of America. Now, on with the episode.
And now, the definition.
The end of slavery produces a tremendous variety of systems in the situations in the South. It's very complicated and confusing. But everybody understood or had this feeling of going through a revolutionary sort of change. I want to read you from the diary of Louis Manigo. He was a very well-to-do planter in South Carolina and Georgia, rice plantations, cotton plantations, and he visited in 1867 one of his plantations on the Savannah River. And he says, I imagined myself for the moment a planter once more, followed by overseer and driver. But these were only passing momentary thoughts, soon dispelled by the sad reality of affairs. In my conversation with these Negroes, now free, my thoughts turned to other countries. I almost imagined myself with Chinese, Malays, or Indians in the interior of the Philippine Islands. The mutual and pleasant feeling of master towards slave and vice versa is now a dream of the past. A very interesting, odd comment. First of all, we may doubt whether the slaves shared the mutual and pleasant feeling that he thought he had toward them. But things are so alien that Manigo has to search for analogies. Malays. He'd never been to Malaysia. Indians in the interior of the Philippine Islands. In other words, this is about as different a situation as he can imagine. The whole system there has fallen apart. It's totally, the relationship between master and slave, or white and black, is now completely foreign to him. Well, the struggle here is about who's going to own the land and who's going to determine what kind of labor is done on the land. As I've mentioned, the land issue began in the Civil War, remember, with taxation imposed by the federal government on the states, tax commissioners, land seizures, and the sale of some land, not a lot, in the Sea Islands some, to pay these taxes. It also began with the Confiscation Acts, which in theory opened the property of rebels to confiscation, although it required a judicial proceeding to do that, which would have been awfully cumbersome and complicated. And then there was Sherman's Field Order number 15, which just did distribute land to significant numbers of African Americans on the coast of South Carolina and Georgia in these 40-acre units. Now, one of the first things in the summer of 1865, one of the first things that President Andrew Johnson does when he comes into office after Lincoln's assassination is to order the restoration of all this land back to the pre-war owners, except land that had actually been sold, which was a very, very small proportion. So the guys on the Sea Island who bought that land kept it. But all the Sherman land is going to go back to the former owners. Any land on which there were other places in Virginia, North Carolina, some other places where blacks had been settled on land, Davis Bend, remember, out in Mississippi, all that land is to be restored to the former owners. Once they've been pardoned, and Johnson starts pardoning them all very, very fast, so that's not a problem. And so now The Freedmen's Bureau head in South Carolina, Rufus Saxton, a general who was an abolitionist, condemned this. He protested. He said this was an egregious breach of faith with the former slaves to promise them land and then take it away. But there was not much that anyone could do. This was Johnson's order. And so by the end of 1865, most of this land that was in the hands of the federal government, much of it being tilled by black workers, was to being restored. They said, you can stay there until the harvest this year, but as of January 1st, the owners are coming back to take over ownership of the land. General O.O. Howard, the head of the Freedmen's Bureau, made a famous trip to Edisto Island, one of the Sea Islands, in which he addressed gathering of slaves, telling them that they would, that the owners were coming back and they would have to sign labor. If they wanted to stay, they would have to sign labor contracts to go to work for the owners and give up the idea of land. Now, this didn't just happen overnight or peacefully. There was a lot of resistance in the Sea Islands and elsewhere, particularly in coastal South Carolina and Georgia and the islands. Slaves, former slaves, barricaded themselves on plantations, took up arms, they had to send the Union Army in some places to disrupt these protests of former slaves not wanting to give up the land that they said they had, they considered that they had been promised this land. Now, Sherman, of course, had not 100% promised that they would own it forever. He was settling them on it. It was rather ambiguous. The Freedmen's Bureau bill was rather ambiguous, but certainly they thought they'd been promised this land. Moreover, the planters had abandoned the area. Now they were coming back. So in 1865, there was no one there to challenge them until Johnson orders this back. And also, this Sea Island area is the home of a very close-knit black community, a very unique black community, which dated way back into the 18th century. They had their own language, which we call Gullah. I don't know if anyone's ever visited down there, a particular dialect with a lot of African influence. So there was a very tight-knit community there. They hadn't been sold away in the way that people from there, in the way that people had in many other parts of the South. Stephen Elliott, a planter returning to Beaufort, was greeted by his slaves who said, there's a letter from me, he said, they told me, we own this land now. Put it out of your head that it will ever be yours again. But unfortunately, they didn't have the ability to enforce that idea. One of the often quoted documents in this, very revealing document in this era, is a petition that a group of slaves on the Sea Islands sent to President Andrew Johnson and to Howard, the head of the Freedmen's Bureau, about this land question. And I just want to read you a couple of sentences from this often quoted petition. This is to Howard. General, we want homesteads. We were promised homesteads by the government. If the government does not carry out the promises its agents made to us, if the government, having concluded to befriend its late enemies and neglect to observe the principle of common faith between itself and us, its allies in the war you said was over, if the government now takes away all right to the soil they stand upon, save such as they can get again by working for your late and their all-time enemies, we are left in a more unpleasant condition than our former slavery. Now, I just want to point out some of the language here, which is quite remarkable, actually, and very revealing about what's going on in Reconstruction. First of all, they say, the war you said was over. Howard comes down and says the war is over. The war between planter and former slave is not over. That war is still going on. The war between North and South is over. Howard says the war is over. From the point of view of these former slaves, the war is not over by any means. The government is now befriending its late enemies, the former Confederates, and therefore not its former allies. And the other phrase, your late, working for your late and their all-time enemies. The planters were the enemies of the North. Now they're not, but they are the all-time enemies. There is an irrepressible conflict between master and slave, which continues over into the freedom era. So these guys have a pretty clear recognition of what is going on, much clearer than O.O. Howard did or Andrew. Well, Johnson had a clear idea, as we'll see, but he wanted to side with the planters, so that was not a problem. But certainly the whole goal of the, this is the crisis of free labor here, the goal of the Freedmen's Bureau is to reconcile the interests of former master and former slave. But they are telling him they are irreconcilable. Their interests are irreconcilable. And if that's the case, it poses a lot of problems for Reconstruction. One more quote that I want to read you related to this from a planter in Mississippi in 1865, talking about his former slaves. He says, this is in his diary, he says, "I do not know what their plans are for another year, but I think they want to farm on their own. They have an idea that a hireling, that is someone working for wages, is not a free man. Our Negroes have not been disposed to entertain the idea of hiring at all. They want to rent land. Our Negroes have a fall, a tall fall ahead of them. They will learn that freedom and independence are different things. A man may be free and yet not independent. The Negroes think that if they are hirelings, they will still be slaves." This is an amazing little document. They think that the person who works for wages is not truly free. What's going on here is a fundamental redefinition of what freedom is in American life. That's part of the crisis of Reconstruction. Who else had we heard some weeks ago saying the man who works for wages his entire life is not free? I'm talking about another person who has spent, we've spent a lot of time talking about. The man who works for wages, the North offers people the opportunity to get out of the wage system. If you work for wages your whole life, you're not truly free. That's Abraham Lincoln. That's Abraham Lincoln. The slaves are repeating a very common idea before the Civil War, that freedom, it goes back to Jefferson, freedom means economic independence. Working for wages is fine as a temporary condition, but not as a permanent life sentence, so to speak. But Reverend Agnew says, the planter says, no, a man may be free and yet not independent. That's the planter idea. They may be free, but that doesn't give them any other rights. It certainly doesn't give them the right to economic autonomy. They have to go back to work on the plantations, and that does not interfere with their freedom. So again, this whole question of who will control the labor of these former slaves it's really part of a fundamental debate about what freedom is in the aftermath of the Civil War. Now, here's a cartoon from Harper's Weekly, "The Great Labor Question from a Southern Point of View." A planter is sitting on his veranda reading the newspaper. He's got his wife and child next to him. Some black people are working out in the fields, and there's one guy with a hoe and a pickaxe or something. The great labor question. The planter is saying, "You've got to work. You've got to work." The planter sitting there doing nothing is saying to this guy who has the implements of work, "You've got to work." This is a, what is this cartoon? This is a kind of ironic or sarcastic comment on what Sidney Andrews points out in the document in the Janap book. The ubiquitous complaint in the White South in 1865 that blacks will no longer work. The free Negro will not work. As one person wrote, "There is no power to make the Negroes work, and without that, they will not work." How to make them go back to work? Now, of course, this is absurd. They're doing all the work to begin with. The guy sitting in his rocking chair is worrying about whether someone out in the fields is willing to work. But this was ubiquitous in the Southern press. in 1865 and for many years after the end of slavery. What's interesting about this, in a way, is there's a racial element in this, and you'll find it all over. They're just inherently lazy. They don't want to work. But if you step back for a minute, you'll find the English said the same thing about the Irish. Every colonial power said the same thing about colonial peoples, whether it's Africans, people in India, people in China. They don't want to work. You hear echoes of this today, that people just basically don't want to work. And some people take from that the, for example, the debate that's been, it's still going on, about extending unemployment insurance, which ran out for the long-term unemployed a few months ago. And Senator Paul of Kentucky, I quote Senator Paul not because I have any animus toward him more than anyone else, but I give him credit because he says what a lot of people think but don't want to say. Paul says, people are lazy. That's why they're unemployed. If you give them unemployment benefits, they just won't work. So the way to make people work is to starve them, basically. Force them to go to work. Now, of course, in the North, the free labor ideology had a different idea. Lincoln's idea and all these others was, no, you give people positive incentives. The reason people work is to improve their condition in life, to acquire goods, to improve the condition of their family. You give them benefits from work, and they'll all go and work. You don't have to whip them. You don't have to force them. You don't have to starve them. You create opportunities for them, which they can gain through labor. That's the free labor idea. But, of course, Southerners said that doesn't apply to blacks. Blacks are so inherently lazy that they will not. In fact, the argument then went, therefore, you've got to pay them very low wages. Don't pay them high. In the North, you say, give them good wages and they'll work. No, give them low wages, because if you give them too much, they'll stop working as soon as they can eat, you see? So you keep wages low to force people to work. That's the sort of... this whole idea... But then the other question is, what do you mean by work? What is work anyway? You might say that's pretty easy to define, but it's not. Here's a memorial from the Cotton Planters Convention of Macon, Georgia, okay? The Negro in freedom is, Negro labor in freedom is 30% inferior to what it was in a condition of servitude. All plans to have failed to overcome the characteristic indolence, laziness, of the Negro. The history of Negro communities proves they will not work as laborers and will be satisfied to subsist, that is to survive, and will add nothing to those products which the world especially needs. In other words, what they're really getting at is that blacks will not work in a market orientation. That is to say, they will subsist. They will grow food for themselves, which actually involves work, but they will not produce the products the world especially needs, i.e. cotton. This is a cotton planters. Buried in this argument is the fear that blacks will not act as market-oriented individuals. You know, our economists, classical economists of the 19th century, basically see mankind as composed of what they call rational, profit-maximizing individuals. The economy functions because people want to maximize their income and their consumption. So therefore, if you make more money growing cotton, you'll grow cotton and you'll buy your food. That makes more sense than growing food where you don't gain any income and you can't buy it, you can't be part of the market. But the argument is blacks are not rational profit-maximizing individuals. They're lazy, but laziness also involves just a lack of desire to participate in the market. They value non-economic things like family stability, like freedom of movement, like freedom from gang labor or control by overseers to monetary incentives. Now, this is not true in many ways. There are plenty of blacks who went on strike in this period for higher wages and responded to market incentives. But people who worked for themselves were not considered working. See, the underlying assumption here is that work means work for a white employer. So here's a North Carolina planter. Want of ambition will be the devil of the race, these blacks. some of my most sensible men say they have no other desire than to cultivate their own land and grain and raise bacon. That's laziness. It actually takes work to cultivate your land in grain and raise bacon, i.e. pigs. But that's not working for a white person. That's working for yourself, and that is not work. So this whole question of will blacks work, it has to be retranslated. Will they work on a plantation under white supervision? And the argument is no, they don't want to do that.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vladimir Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast segment. The Confederization of America. There are certain symbols and signs that appear in a society where a schizophrenic fact which has been ignored refuses to be ignored anymore, comes to the surface and presents itself as a malady representing its deepest realities, its deepest revelations in the actions of people within that society. One such sign and symbol is great men and women appear who agitate the psycho-spiritual mind in the society to force a choice by those capable of making the choice and thus directing the vital essences in that society towards the ends which that choice mandates. Reading history, I found there are certain cooling off periods in the United States where it seems less is happening on the ground, less is thus happening in the society, but things are still moving, chugging along. But seldom are there not great people in that time span? Great example is the first decade of the 20th century. Yes, there are definitely big figures, but the agitations of the 1890s had culminated in some really big changes starting to take hold. So there was kind of a smoothing of the society, even as there was radicalization being imprinted and implanted throughout every level in the society. In recent memory, the United States has gone through a drastic cooling off period. Now, it is clear to me that part of that cooling off period was inauthentic. It was imposed rather than naturally occurring. It was the equivalent of creating snow for a ski slope during a winter when no snow is falling in significant amounts. You actually, by creating the snow, you actually change the dynamics of the environment. Snow is not just snow. It's not just frozen water. There is a chemistry to it, which interacts brilliantly with the micro ecology within the mountainside, which is not activated and acted with the fake snow. This unnatural cooling down period began in the 1980s, possibly even in the 1970s with disco, but it went on steroids in the 1980s, and by the mid to late 90s, it was in full implementation. The radicalization, which had marked the 1960s and the 1970s, was deemed to be exclusively something of the past, which is dangerous for a society. Because once when radicalization stops, the society has not the ability to procreate anymore. It is similar to when the body runs low on probiotics and prebiotics. Without prebiotics, the flora which your body uses to actually digest and metabolize food and water and air grinds to a halt. The prebiotics help to produce the probiotics, which then starts this chain reaction of creating more prebiotics, which create more probiotics, which creates more prebiotics and probiotics and so on and so forth, until the body doesn't only have those resources, horrible name for it, sorry, those elements, those micro organisms in the gut, but just like they existed when you were a young child, now they're throughout your body. And so when you're talking about burning fat for anybody trying to lose weight, understand that's a huge part of it. Most people in the United States have horrible, I believe the name is called, is microbiomes, but you don't have enough probiotics, prebiotics, all of that flora has been destroyed. Radicals, fundamentally intellectual radicals, like those that existed in the early part of the 20th century, came into vogue in the latter part of the 1800s, and really drove at an intellectual level a lot of movements in this country. From the pre-Civil War years, they were the ones who advocated abolitionists, many of them, to the 1960s. Those are the people who took in the rhetoric of the society, the philosophical underpinnings of the society, and they digested them. And they contemplated the thorough meaningness behind them. And they recognized through that digestion, whether or not those ideas would create a better society or a worse society. Just like when a body is working in incredible balance, you introduce something that is unnatural and is going to harm the body immediately springs into action, recognizes this thing. It has to first identify, okay, what is it? It recognizes that it's harmful immediately, and it goes through a process of excreting it out of your body with the least amount of impact on your health. Now, sometimes that may render you tired for a day or two. Sometimes that may render you bedecked with or beset with cold symptoms for a day or two. But then, after that, you're fine. Your body excretes what it has to excrete, gets rid of that toxin, and you go on about your life. This was the role of radicals. Not as many police departments had hired radicals to be, which were destructive, nihilistic revolutionaries. No, these people were the digestive agents of the society. Thus, by getting rid of that, by getting rid of them, should I say, the society was getting rid of the instrument of metabolic production. They were getting rid of the instrument for metabolic production within the body. Now, a society makes a choice in that direction. Usually not at the ground level. Usually it's at the middling and upper levels. But there's a choice. And there's often a choice to get rid of the radical members for the nihilistic members, whom at the outset seem radical-like. They perform some of the same tasks as the radicals. They take in things. They digest them. But what they produce is drastically different. What they produce is supportive of institutions which grind down liberties in the name of liberty. Grinds down freedom in the name of freedom. Grinds down justice in the name of being just. They are the negative bacterium that also exists in your body and has to some extent exist in your body to keep the other stuff honest. But once when you get rid of the good stuff, the bad stuff explodes. The bad stuff explodes. And thus, here we are. In the United States, there was always two societies. There was the authoritarian society that most black and red and brown people lived under. There is the authoritarian society which many European immigrants who moved to the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s lived under. And then there is the blessed minority, who lived a relatively free and prosperous life. And they were very much a minority. Let's not even get this twisted. When we're talking about those people who didn't live in either agrarian realities or abject poverty in this country, you are really talking up until the 1940s, the 1950s, you're really talking about 15% of the population. You weren't talking about that many people. Even though the productive capacity in this country, the money-making capacity in this country, provided enough financial resources and material wealth to drive that number from 15 easily to 50. It was just the wealthy, the people with the most money, those who are financially obese, as I called them in one episode, they didn't want to do it. So they refused. And thus, about 15% of the population, probably a little bit less, lived in relative comfort, while the other 85%+ did not. In the 1950s, that changed. And that changed dramatically. At the same time, it was changing. And that idea of the middling class was expanded drastically. So, you know, you went from 15% now to 30%, to 35%, to 40%, maybe even as high as 50% of the population or more. Probably, in fact. These same people who a generation or two earlier, mostly a generation because of the Great Depression, had experienced drastic hardships. They refused to extend the luxury to the luxuries which they were now enjoying to most non-white people. They, in essence, wanted to maintain the system which they themselves were being lifted out of for other people not like themselves, while they themselves were able to live amongst those who had been their oppressors. So they wanted that authoritarian that authoritarian system to remain in place for non-white people. But if you were white, if you were from Europe, you should have a way out of that authoritarian concept. And so there was a choice made. And it was a destructive choice, but it was a choice nonetheless. Now, the reason I called this the Confederization of the country is because that authoritarian system was writ large in the former Confederate States and in the South. Which, by the way, despite the history of what people like to say, included places like South California, Southern California. That system, which had really eaten black pride and ownership and wealth up, relied heavily, and I do mean heavily, on an agreement between lower class whites, middle class whites, and upper class whites to make sure that the terroristic leanings of those in power, and that's who they usually elected, not always, but when you went to local government, those were the people who typically were in charge. They were very not good people, often sadistic, often authoritarian people. But there is an alignment there, which enabled the system to keep black people, to keep brown people, to keep non-white people strangled to the ground with no power. And when, after World War II ended, the New Deal began to produce new opportunities and new realities for white people, they wanted black folks to remain in the authoritarian condition that they had always remained in, or they had always existed in. And they were dumbfounded, for some reason, that black people said, no, we're not doing that. We will not do that. And so there was a fight for a while about whether or not that system would be done away with. Well, it wasn't. There was a decision that was made at the federal government to reintegrate most of these people into the national system. The problem was, when you put together the authoritarian mechanisms in the urban ghettos, and really the urban cities, excuse me, because they were mostly cities before they were the ghettos, You combine that with what was going on the authoritarian model in the South, what you discover is that the majority of the country was actually run through this authoritarian principle. So when you started integrating the South into the structures that existed in the North, you didn't get a liberalization in the South. You got a reinforcement. You got a reinforcement of the authoritarian systems in the urban cities. And you got a new philosophy that gave credibility, to some of the most ethnocentric Euro-nationalist people in those, during the 50s and 60s, surrounding those urban centers. And why I say in those urban centers is because most of these ethno-Euro-nationalists lived in the inner cities. They came from Europe in the past two generations, and they were very, very, very supportive of their little clans. And then once when the New Deal started opening up opportunities for them to move to the suburbs, they quickly moved to the suburbs, let mostly blacks and Hispanics and stuff move into the inner city, and then quickly forgot how life was when they lived in the inner city, and were quick to throw mud at these people who were suddenly demonstrating the same type of pathologies that they had been demonstrating. So they then became very anti-black. They then became very anti-non-white. And they were buoyed with that sentiment by the philosophies coming out of the South. And we still see that today. This created a new alignment and a new alliance between the suburban, ethnocentric, Euro-nationalist in the North, in the Midwest, and in the South. And in the South. They forgot in the North and in the Midwest how much government attention had been paid to make sure that they could stand on their feet. They didn't care to remember that. They forgot that it had taken two generations to build them up, including massive, 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 massive investments during the New Deal era. They didn't care to remember that. And the South, who never cared about remembering any of it, or actually, I can't say they didn't care to remember any of it, because the South didn't care to cared if black people brought that stuff up. They just would say, that's because, you know, we're superior than you. We're better than you. And they knew how to dress it up in a fashion and in a way that made it sound scientific. These people had been doing it for a long time. And so they brought those skills from the South to the North and started convincing all of these people of the righteousness of their disdain for black people. And so you didn't have a liberalization of the South. You had a reverse happen. You had an authoritarianization of the North. It was during this period of time, during these changes, that you see these figures starting to emerge. And I'm, you know, through the books that I've been listening to at work, you know, you can see this happening. These people who look like they were intellectual leaders and what have you, who weren't intellectual leaders. They just seem new to the North. These people who were more interested in power than anything else. Because, see, in the South, what people have always failed to understand, or should I say even admit, the South was a jungle when it came to politics. The South was a jungle when it came to politics. It was about ruthless power down there. And if you didn't have the guts to not only wield power, but gain it in the first place, you'd be banished. And sometimes through some very, very rough means. There's, God, I can't even remember anymore where it was at, but it was, there's a story that's been floating around recently about a coup in a border state during the waning years of Reconstruction. And, you know, people look at that today and they're like, oh my God, really? Really? Do none of you understand that there are whole chapters of history that have been wiped clean from the South? Things that my father told me about that nobody knows about to this day that happened in the South. Mayors that would disappear, clergymen that would disappear, all kinds of political stuff would happen. They worked under a different credo. And the North didn't get that. So they would look at these people and say, oh, well, they're intellectual. Not understanding that these people weren't intellectual. They were aiming for power. And that's all that mattered to them. They would say what they had to do, pretend to be what they had to pretend to be in order to gain power. Because that was how politics worked in the South. It was about power. Strictly about power. Why do you think it was difficult for black people to make advancements? And when they did make advancements, why do you think it was only the most decrepit black person who was willing to sell out its own people who could make it the farthest? Or it was the black person who knew how to straddle the line between being submissive and being really submissive? Because it was all about power for these people. And it has been this principle that has washed across the country. Rush Limbaugh is a great example of this. Great example of this. The man cares nothing about anything. He doesn't have an empathetic bone in his body. It's all about power for him. That's what he speaks about. People sent him well wishes when he was sick, and they meant it, genuinely meant it. Rush Limbaugh wouldn't give two GDs if somebody who he thought was in the way of power for his conservative crew, if they got sick and almost died. He wouldn't care. And he'll dismiss that. Oh, he doesn't know me. I've called this person and I've called that person and I've called da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There is in the South, there is a concept, which I forget the name of it now. My father told me about this back when I was a kid, where a person would, for lack of a better term, gaslight empathy. They would make you pretend that it was about empathy, when in fact, it was about the idea of looking the part. The South was a brutally hostile place for politics. And the people who executed politics there knew it. Now, does this mean everybody there was bad? No. But the environment cannot be mistaken as anything but a projection of the politics of the geography. And if you go to a place like Mississippi, you still see this. Now, the power in the South, the power structure in the South was 100% fascist. No question about it. The Klan literally was a fascist organization. It's not even a question. And the fact that nobody has ever put that together is concerning to me. It was a fascist organization. I recognized this almost 10 years ago when I started reading about fascism. The Klan was a fascist organization. At the very basic level, the idea of corporatism governed the Klan. Nationalism was a very close second to the corporatism which they utilized. It was the associations of associations that formed the basis of the Klan. And it was those associations, it was within those associations that you'd find a lot of the corporate members of the community, of the cities, of the areas in which people lived. Now, not everybody who joined the Klan was a bad person. As my father said, in many areas in the South, you couldn't do business unless, you were part of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm sorry, the Klan. I'm not equating the Chamber of Commerce with the Klan. Though there's some interesting history that sort of overlaps the two. But I digress. You could not do business in those areas unless you were part of the Klan. You couldn't. And if you crossed the group, the best case scenario, when I say cross the group, by the way, I'm talking about, maybe you went to the North and got spotted, talking to some abolitionists or what have you. Or maybe you advocated for collective black persons' rights. Maybe you made the mistake of advocating for black rights altogether. Not looking out for an employee, not looking out for a family on your block, things like that. But something much more societal societally altering. The best case scenario was you're kicked out of the group. The worst case scenario was the second to last worst case scenario obviously was you're kicked out of the community, possibly even the state. The ultimate worst case scenario was, well, you know where that is. That's. So it was the realities in the South were very, very stark, and everybody understood it. The glorious South, the glorious past idea in the South also motivated a lot of this. And black people, if they were allowed to take power, would tarnish that glorious past, which has to do also with fascism. But at the end of the day, the ruthlessness attached to the politics was what really defined the South. And it has, that ruthlessness has poisoned the United States ever since integration for the white, quote, Southern majority has become a priority. What do we do to stop it? I don't know. It's not about education, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about education. Because you're not going to teach these people not to be who they are. I recently had a conversation with one of my supervisors. Actually, it wasn't recent. It was like 2 years ago. Wow. Time goes by. But we were talking about something. And he said something about babies being born, and that babies are born, you know, like as a blank slate, and, you know, depends on how they're raised on whether or not they're good or not. And I said, I wholly reject that. Wholly reject it. 100% reject it. I've met some very, very small kids born to parents who were really great people. And that child was not good. And I watched that child grow up and seen what he did and knew he was not good. And sometimes I've been proven right, and other times I haven't known him long enough, you know, afterwards to either be proven right or wrong. But most of the ones that I've looked at and said, yeah, that kid ain't, there's something wrong with that baby. Yeah. Yes, it's proven correct. And for that reason, you can't educate them out of that. But also, there's just a certain group of people that are going to gravitate towards that authoritarian niche. So I don't know really what you do. You can make life better, but actually, I suppose the only thing that you can do, and this came up in Sociopath Next Door. The only thing you can do is you'd have to change the culture. Because in cultures where selfishness isn't tolerated, you have a lot fewer sociopaths. A lot fewer. I believe Taiwan, a major study there on how many people show sociopathic, psychopathic tendencies. They're like under 1%. But in the United States, it's believed to be 4%. I believe it's probably a little higher. So, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. You guys know I love hearing from you. I am your brother, Vimer Deese. See you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom.
and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.